Well, the Thursday show got off to a cracking start, and Rob Herzhoff is back with us today for, well, Mark 2. I say cracking start, Rob, because anybody who'd listened to you last week will be delighted to see that your forecast, your prediction, call it what you like, about Bitcoin is on the money, over $100,000 this morning. So, what's caused it to jump like this, 7% overnight?
Well, it's not just overnight. It's been the last month has been up 20-something percent.
40 since Trump was elected, and 7% last night. Mm.
So I've been buying Bitcoin for 7 months or so, and my average price is around 70,000. But the most amusing part of it is I did predict 100,000 before the end of the year, and I was getting nervous because it was bobbing around in the 90s, but it cracked the 100,000 mark, and I'm thrilled. But the most kind of amusing side of it is 2 weeks ago, my wife had no idea about blockchain, Bitcoin, crypto. And I said to her, you know, we've got quite a big Bitcoin holding. I think it might make sense for you to actually know what this is all about. And she's super smart. I mean, she's very intelligent. And she spent 2 days watching YouTube, reading, summarizing books, using, you know, AI to summarize articles and videos. And after 2 days, she said, right, I get it. I understand it completely. And I'd like to open an account. I'd like to buy Bitcoin with my own money. And I'd like to open a trading account. I said, oh, really? What are you going to buy? She said, I'm going to buy Ripple, Solana, and I'll think about other things. But Bitcoin's going to be our family base. And then I'll, Kate Herzhoff, be the trader. Anyway, her nickname's now either Crypto Queen or Ripples, because she's been telling anyone who'll listen how it all works, what to buy. And she's up, you know, way beyond my portfolio. She's had a home run. And I keep saying to her, things do go down. Okay, just be careful. But she's on a roll. And I suppose I should make a prediction for where Bitcoin is going. I just own Bitcoin when it comes to the crypto space. And I think it's going to hit $250,000 at the end of next year. But my price target is $1 million. And I think that's 2 to 3 years hence. And it's very easy to study it. Just, you know, go onto YouTube, and there are some very good videos on understanding blockchain, understanding Bitcoin, and understanding the other crypto. I think the big reason it's starting to move now is people have realized that corporations, the big seven, all of them have massive cash holdings. And on December the 10th, Microsoft's having its board meeting. And Michael Saylor, who's the biggest holder of Bitcoin in the world, his company MicroStrategy, was given a 3-minute slot to present to the board. He's done that presentation. Please, everybody, tribesmen, go online and have a look. Michael Saylor, prediction for Bitcoin and his presentation to Microsoft, 3 minutes. And he does it very quickly because he only had 3 minutes. He had a lot of slides. So listen to it, watch it one time, and then go back and do it again, but put playback on 0.5 so you can actually read the slides. And it says it all. Corporations are going to start using their treasury assets, their balance sheet, their cash holdings to buy Bitcoin. They're going to hold their cash in Bitcoin because you can convert it immediately into fiat currency. The second reason is states in America and governments across the world are going to start announcing this month, next month, and going forward, Bitcoin is a strategic reserve asset. And the minute some countries do it, then others will do it, and it will fly. The demand for Bitcoin will go through the roof. So I think I had a friend at lunch yesterday, Brandon Becker. He said, Rob, am I not too late? And I said, you're not. This is, you do it now, right now. And, you know, open a trading account, a Kraken account, very good one, and a cold wallet. A cold wallet means you can actually store it safely offline.
If you old-fashioned, you can read their two brilliant books, The Bitcoin Standard and The Fiat Standard, and you can buy them on Amazon. Hard to get hold of the hard copy, although at the BizNews conference, we always have plenty of them, so you'll be able to get one there. That's only in March, though. It might be a little late for the person who's trying to invest, but What I am interested in is that your wife, Kate, decided to go in, go and do her own homework. And after doing her homework, she didn't come back and say, this is rat poison. She opened her mind. She is a, as you say, she's well qualified, a medical doctor. So she's certainly smart enough to get it. And after opening her mind, having a look at what is available, I suppose she could have listened to or watched one or two of Stafford Marcy's talks on the BizNews TV channel. But after doing all of that, no longer saying, well, I don't understand it, so bugger off, it must be rubbish. She actually is an investor. And I think that's really the process that most of us have had to go through with Bitcoin. Mine happened on a golf course, would you believe, when John T. Sachs said to me, you know, we really think that you need to look at Bitcoin again. And after shanking my next shot because I was so angry, I stopped and calmed down and, well, and did my own research. And really, to me, Rob, it's even simpler than all of that. If you look at gold, what is gold worth? There's very little utility, but people through the ages have believed that gold has got value. Bitcoin, people believe, many people, many smart people believe it's an alternative to fiat currencies, so it has value. It doesn't have to be backed by a house or anything else. It has value because we believe it has value. And that is a similar thing with all fiat currencies, by the way. They're not backed by gold or anything else. And I kind of got that when I read those books. The penny dropped. And now we bought into MicroStrategy in the business portfolio. Now it's 10% of the portfolio. It started at 2%. And we switched it all into a Bitcoin trust. So it just now, the portfolio just reflects what happens to Bitcoin. But I guess for us, if you were to talk to any investment advisor and say, hey, you've got 10% of your portfolio in Bitcoin, they'd say, you're mad. Well, we started at 2%. We now got 10%. We're going to stay at 10%.
And so, Alec, is it a coincidence or is it entirely correlated that your golf has improved significantly since you bought Bitcoin?
Well, I haven't had to well, let's not say anything more about the golf, Rob. You know, as we all know, it's ups and downs. But thank you for sharing that with us last week, because those people who are sitting on the sidelines and don't really understand why they should be paying attention to something that Warren Buffett says is like rat poison. But remember, Warren Buffett also says that gold is worthless. So it's his mind. He's brilliant, but he has that type of a mind which says, unless it's an asset that's generating income for me, it's not worth anything. Well, you know, since time immemorial, people have believed there has to be a store of value in gold or so on. So it is, by you saying what you said, there are many Rob Herzog fans who are suddenly looking at Bitcoin differently.
Happy to help.
Okay, so let's move away from Bitcoin onto the other issue that you've been talking a lot about, to become South Africa's Elon Musk, not in the sense of starting your own space company, but in going into government and helping to deregulate or the issues that South Africa is facing. Because my goodness, before we get there, there was an announcement this week of Cyril Ramaphosa's economic team, 19 members, no Rob Herzog, no, in fact, no businessman on that. And Cyril's again relying on academics and bureaucrats and some pretty left-wing thinkers to pull South Africa out of the malaise that it's in. You got to wonder about that story of what's the definition of insanity.
Exactly. I mean, you make the point absolutely. It's not one business person. There are 19 members. How do you get anything done with 19 policy wonks sitting around the table who are all professorial with master's degrees who've never actually created any wealth in their lives? And, you know, you have hardcore lefties on there, like London-based leftist heroine Mariana Mazzucato, you know, working with people or trying to work with people who have a sensible view of how to create economic growth and sensible policy. They're just going to disagree and go all over the place and come up with something that's absolutely a waste of time, useless, and no one's going to read it. But that's what Cyril does. You know, Cyril has never Cyril's not a businessman. You know, his businesses that he owns have been handouts to him. You know, he was the BEE darling. Everyone backed him. He talked a good game. He's never actually looked at income, cost, and profitability and said, we need to cut these costs. We need to be more productive. We need to be more efficient. He's had other people do that for him. So he's just a jolly Santa Claus who hands out gifts to everyone. And all he's done here is hand out, and I'm wondering how much he's paying each of these 19. He's handing out gifts to all of them to like kiss for you, a thank you for you. They're going to get nothing done. It's the most pointless waste of time ever. And I remember, and I can't remember who was on, there were three people that Cyril appointed 4 or 5 years ago. Jacques-Marie was one of them, and he I rate very highly, but there were three other people supposed to evangelize South Africa for foreign direct investment. Well, what happened to that? Bet you that went nowhere. So all Cyril's doing, as with the cabinet, is say, oh, look, let's have a few more ministers and thank this person and give money to this person. You know, he's Father Christmas. He's absolutely useless, spineless and useless. And this is exactly what's come out in this, you know, policy wonk, you know, 19 person, go nowhere, cost the country money, bunch of Marxists mixed in with maybe some sensible professors. It's a complete and utter waste of time. Reflected in our cabinet, I mean, our cabinet is 32 ministers. What a joke. And 43 deputy ministers. We have 75 ministers. Javier Milei in Argentina went from 18 down to 8, just cut the ministries and added one more, a minister of deregulation. And that's the job we need in South Africa. We need an axe man or an axe woman and a minister of cutting cost, cutting waste, cutting bureaucracy and deregulation urgently, because there's so much fat and waste and corruption at the top that needs to be cut.
So I've put on screen the Free Market Foundation's image that they put together and one that you sent me. So it's clearly in line with the way that you are thinking. These are the ministries that should be retained, in your opinion. Just explain this to us, if you would.
So these are the only ministries that matter. They're the big ones. They're the ones where we need a minister, we need a budget, we need focus, and we need sensible spending. You know, there is a presidency. That's how we're set up, including, if we have to have him, Paul Mashatile, or someone better, hopefully soon. Minister of Finance, you know, Enoch, terrific. Good guy. I rate him highly. And by the way, yesterday I had a conversation with David Masondo. What an impressive human being. I mean, Enoch and David, we've got some very good people there. Defense, you have to, you know, no matter how along the spectrum of libertarianism you are and small government, you do need defense. But under defense, you can obviously handle, you know, not just protecting against attack, invasion, and threats, but also border control. That should be there. On international relations, absolutely, you need it. Justice, we have to have, and we're going to get back to our disastrous Cyril decision on Thembi Simelane. We'll get to that in a second. Home Affairs, you'd incorporate police correctional services in there. Cooperative government, yes. Public service, yes. Public works and social development. But look at under public works and social development. You know, you take these other ministries and just merge them underneath those. So in the end, you have a president that knows what he or she is doing, is focused, and only have 9 people reporting to him or her. You have 10, 11 people around the table. That's how you get things done. Whenever I see a business that has 25 people on the board, you know it's just a waste of time. It's not going to happen. You need excellent people in these positions and go from there, and you'll save billions.
Executive committee of 9 people. It's still a bit big, but if you're running a country, an exco of 9 rather than an exco of over 30. So these are the guys that will be scrapped, consolidated, devolved. Now, we do have people who are not watching, so we need to also spell it out. They're just listening to this as a podcast. Please do that for us. Who would you, and who, well, the Free Market Foundation are proposing it, and you clearly go along with it on the ministries that would be scrapped.
So, you know, when I was studying what Elon and Ramaswamy are planning to do on Doge, you know, and then study what Javier Milei is doing in Argentina, and there are other countries also trying to tackle waste, corruption, bureaucracy, inefficiency. You know, I made a few calls, and what one of the first calls is to David Ansara of this Free Market Foundation. And I said, look, I'm pulling together a small group, small young team of smart people. And what I'm going to do is help create a narrative, create momentum on cutting waste, bureaucracy, and overregulation from the South African blob, the swap, the South African swamp. And I'm not surprised. David had already begun the work. He was already down the line, and he sent me these charts. So I didn't ask his permission. I'm sure he's fine me showing it. But let's talk about which ministries you can scrap. You've got these people sitting around the table. They've got budgets. In other words, they've got money that they need to spend and they want to spend. And that's ridiculous. You shouldn't have money that you need and want to spend. You should actually say, what does the country need? What are the public goods that the country needs? Roads, we need roads, we need defense, we need justice system, we need, you know, health, we need education. Right, let's work out what's called a zero-based budget. Instead of looking at what we spent the last fiscal cycle and then saying, you need a bit less, you need a bit more, and going from there, every time round, we should do a zero-based budget. We should start from zero. Assume that we have the 1,900 billion, which is the number, 1,900 billion rand. What do we spend it on? What are the really important things that the country needs? Well, firstly, if you take the 1,900 billion rand, you've got to spend almost 400 billion on debt service. This is money the government's borrowed. So of that budget that you want to spend on things for South Africans in South Africa, you've actually got to give away 400 billion of that to pay debt. Okay? Because you've got a debt that's ballooning. And the grants that Cyril's been throwing out and promising everybody is another almost 400 billion. So you've got almost 800 billion of the 1,900 billion that just gone on day one. Okay? You have about 1,000, let's call it 200 billion left. And of that, 500 billion goes to health and education. And when it comes to health and education, people go, oh, you can't touch that. Well, you can, because a lot of it's being wasted. So you need someone that can go in there and see what's being wasted, get rid of tenderpreneurs, get rid of middlemen, reduce that amount. But if you take the, let's call it 800 billion of debt service grants and the 500 billion of health and education, you've only got 700 billion rand left to spend on everything else. So you know that the right way to do it is start from zero and say, okay, we have to pay debt, but let's find a way to reduce debt. Grants, okay, let's make them more efficient. I'm sure there are middlemen making a fortune there. And then at least try and have a much larger budget that we can produce and invest on things that really matter for South Africans, you know, infrastructure, roads, hospitals, things like that, things that make a difference. South Africa's got so much waste, so much fat, so much bureaucracy, and so many people earning money between the budget and the recipients that it's a joke. So I would scrap all of these ministries. Why do we need a ministry for women? I mean, what is their budget and what do they use it for? Ridiculous. I thought men and women are treated equally. Damn, well, ought to be. And you don't need a ministry for women. You know, do we really need a ministry of sports, arts, and culture? No. Sorry, Gayton. I mean, actually, you've done a hell of a good job, Gayton, but you should be in a much bigger, tougher job. Trade, industry, and competition. That can fall under another ministry. And on the consolidation, you know, we take ministries, push them together, devolve the ministries that are pointed out on the slide and the ministries that just should fall under other ministries. And you make it a much more efficient, focused government, a much more efficient, focused South Africa. We would save hundreds and hundreds of billions of rand. And it's very easy to do. But Cyril's not the right guy to do it. He's too spineless. He's too weak. He just wants to have more ministers and more committees and hand out presents. And terrible. I mean,
well, it's other people's money, isn't it, Rob? And the other people in this case is every single taxpayer in South Africa. And that's not just very wealthy people who pay lots of income tax. It's also the gogo who goes to go and buy her groceries every week. She's kicking in 15% to government through VAT. That goes to fund these ministries. It's also when you buy a motor vehicle, you have to pay 15% to government to fund the mechanism. It isn't like government just magics up the money from somewhere to spend. It's paid every day by each one of us. So I guess the starting point would be a little education to realize that when we're putting money, whatever we're spending, and when you invest, you even pay part of your dividends that come to you. And when you sell shares you made a profit on, you got to pay capital gains tax. It just never ends. But I need to go through these individual ministries so that those who are listening on the podcast only understand what you're talking about. So you'd scrap women, youth, and persons with disabilities, that a portfolio. You'd scrap agriculture, land reform, and rural development, presumably to put it into another portfolio. Communications and digital technology, mineral resources and energy, public enterprises, small business development, tourism, trade industry and competition, forestry and fisheries, higher education, sports, art and culture, and human settlements. All of those would go. I mean, there's so many there.
Yeah, Alec, that's 12 ministries. Each ministry has an expensive minister roaming around with blue light cars and flying about on the public purse, and earning a big salary and having assistance, and a deputy minister with the same thing, and a budget that they feel they ought to spend, ought to commit. That's 12 ministries gone. The savings, huge.
You also have a director general who's a bureaucrat who is there to sometimes shuffle papers and to try and convince the minister to do this or that, and deputy directors general, and the list goes on and on. Okay, so that's who you'd scrap. Consolidate the deputy president, presumably with the president. Planning, monitoring, and evaluation. What a weird ministry. Transport, electricity, police, health, water, and sanitation. Where would police and health go, Rob? Because those are really big ones.
Under justice.
You'd have a Thembi Simelane justice minister. You had a really good justice minister, and then they would also be responsible for police and health. And then devolve, what does that mean? Labor and employment, police and basic education.
So police would just fall under, you know, I've got police under devolve as well as consolidate, but devolve is pushed down to the states, the provinces, the towns, the municipalities.
So when you just think about this logically, there's a heck of a lot that happens at local level where they don't have the responsibility at the moment. And the Western Cape has been shouting about this forever. But that goes up to some Pretoria will provide kind of organization, which has got layers upon layers upon layers. You know, the one thing, there's lots of that I like about you, Rob, but the one thing I really admire about you is your urgency. Whatever it is that you do, you get on it and you do it. You're on it. When you are working in the public sector, that urgency is by definition missing, because the one thing you're in the public sector for is to, well, to serve the public, okay, but to actually continue to work there pretty much indefinitely. And so you don't take any risks. It's hugely risk averse. You don't have the urgency. And aren't you maybe barking up the wrong tree here? Because you're saying to the public sector, this is what you've got to do. And we urgently need to fix our financial affairs. We urgently need to make things more efficient. But in the public sector, I work when I shuffle a few papers around, when I look busy. There's no outcomes-based performance for me. It's if everybody around me sees me very busy, taking phone calls, in meetings, etc., then I'm earning the taxpayers' money. Well, so I believe, and so do my bosses.
So let's say we had 8 to 10 ministries. And the end of each budget cycle, each ministry came back and said, I don't need the 7 billion rand you've given me for my ministry. I need 6 billion because I've saved a billion. I'm putting that back to Treasury. And Treasury says, okay, we're going to use that to pay down the debt, to reduce the debt, the interest charge. Wouldn't that be amazing? Or wouldn't it be amazing if every ministry on a monthly basis, came back and said, we've found within our ambit 20, 30, 40, 1,000 laws that make no sense, that are very from another century, that we'd like to get rid of. We want to get rid of these regulations and these laws. Instead of, let's create new regulations and laws, which lefties and lawyers and bureaucrats and administrators tend to do, add more laws because we know what's best for everyone. Let's go the other way around. Reward people on identifying stupid laws that don't make sense, that are damaging to the economy, that slow down economic growth and investment. Let's have a ridiculous law website and have people post on the website stupid rules and laws and regulations that make no sense or that need to be got rid of or that are holding us all back. Let's identify them and chop, 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 chop. Donald Trump, when he ran for his first term, said, I'm not going to allow one regulation, new regulation to come in unless we get rid of two old regulations. Genius. Let's implement that law. So bureaucrats should be trying to save money, not spend money, reduce regulation, make things quicker, make things easier, make things more efficient. DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency. And they don't look at that. That's what we want. And just a quick comment on the Auditor General, national and provincial audit outcomes, right? Released last week. And this is now down at the sort of municipal level. And the municipal level is important because these are the critical areas for the poor: energy, water, health, education, which is 77% of spending. And only 17% of the bodies responsible for these critical areas to the poor got clean audits. So it's not just at the top level, at the Cyril cabinet, you know, Pretoria level, that there's corruption, waste, bureaucracy, and inefficiency. It's right down at the municipal level. And I'm pretty sure every single one of those disastrous municipalities are ANC run. They're not DA run, they're not PA run, they're ANC run. So there is a huge amount of waste and inefficiency too. Bring the axe, cut, cut, cut.
But it's not just the South African trend that we're seeing here. People are hurtful. I remember you using that word and using FTSEC ANC as well at the BizNews conferences, but people really are hurtful. And it's not just here. It's almost like there's been a system that's been in place for decades, which is, the pendulum's just swung much too far now. And there's a memory lapse on who actually funds all of this. And so the people who are funding it, which is we the people, are now hurtful and they're saying, we're not prepared to fund this anymore. We better change. And we know in South Africa, but globally, we're seeing a similar trend. Do you think Donald Trump's election is perhaps the biggest signal of that?
Without a doubt, because, you know, America is by far the most powerful country in the world, you know, militarily, economically, technologically, and will be even more so over the next 12, 15 years. America is going to absolutely boom, as I've said before. So, you know, Biden, I mean, what did he do in his 4 years? Nothing, okay? He was senile, did nothing really at all, except get America into wars. Whereas Donald Trump is being upfront about what he wants to do, and he's hitting the ground running already. He's already made his appointments. This is the fastest in any presidential, pre-presidential term, these appointments. So what Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and others are doing is stating exactly what they're going to do, and it's going to impact everyone in the world. You know, there are a lot of good people, like I'd say, you know, almost all the BizNews tribes people, have been suspicious of the left, suspicious of climate change narratives, suspicious of all this nonsense. But there hasn't been, you know, the catalyst that has sort of sparked the fire for us all to stand up and say, you remember that movie in the 70s, the guy screaming out of the window, I have had enough, I've had enough, I've had enough. I can't remember what that movie was.
I'm not going to take it anymore.
I'm not going to take it anymore. And that's where we are right now. You know, there are very few people who have stood up and said, enough, but more and more are doing it, and there's momentum. And we have examples: Javier Milei in Argentina and the Trump presidency. I couldn't be more excited. It'll impact a lot of other countries in the world. I think this momentum, this narrative is spreading fast and furious everywhere. And it's going to be very hard for these, you know, cultural Marxist, leftist ideologues that are, you know, have spread socialism across the world to fight against it. When Helen Ziller a few years ago got beaten up for saying, why should anyone pay tax if we know the government is going to waste it or steal it? She was right. She was absolutely courageous and right to say that. And I read, you know, a month ago that the government's considering a one-off wealth tax on the rich. You know, it's not, that is not going to happen because we know how much waste there is in government. How dare they go to taxpayers and say, we want you to pay more tax? How dare they? They need to clean up their act first. And this narrative momentum spreading worldwide. It's funny because I pulled my group together a week ago and said, come on, let's get this narrative going. And then, you know, you wrote an op-ed, I think, this morning on cost cutting and efficiency. Jonathan Katzenellenberg is a friend of mine, wrote a great article. You know, the momentum is already beginning in South Africa. I'm definitely not the first to say it.
But what is interesting is that these are obvious truths, and it's not something that's being said for the first time, but it's been ignored up until now. And suddenly it's like there's a tipping point. Suddenly people are getting it and understanding it. And it's many of these changes that happen in society, we do get to a tipping point. So it's a long buildup and terribly frustrating for early adopters like yourself. But it does appear as though the tipping point has been reached now in this particular very, very critical area.
So I want to call out a huge thank you to two people who were tipping points of tipping points. I know Trump set the torchlight, set the touch paper. Rupert Murdoch and Elon Musk. Rupert Murdoch, with his publications in the UK, and then Fox Network in America, was the first bulwark against leftist ideology continuing to spread and destroy the Western world and destroy free markets and destroy, you know, the Judeo-Christian civilization and free market Milton Friedman world that we were trying to build. And Fox Network stood up and said, we're going against the grain, we're standing up, and we are going to fight. Rupert Murdoch's contribution to where we are today is immeasurable, and I want to thank him on behalf of all of us for what he did. Secondly, Elon Musk. By not just standing up and supporting Trump and coming on board and donating the $100 million to try and get people to wake up and vote in the right direction, but buying Twitter. Because the mainstream media, hardcore lefties, completely out of touch with where the world is going, you know, infiltrated by Marxism, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, is fundamentally true. The education system is completely infiltrated. We've got to turn that around. But mainstream media, you know, was a force to be reckoned with a while back. And if you added Twitter to that, they had, you know, they were the heavyweight in the room. And Elon Musk overpaid for Twitter by $20 billion. But he bought it and he's turned X into, you know, being on our side against the lefty mainstream media. Rupert Murdoch, Elon Musk, thank you for what you've done for all of us. Thank you for saving the world.
You know, from where we sit, being a media player, what has been interesting is the way that the platforms, the massive platforms that dominate the distribution of media nowadays, have been very controlled. And controlling. And you saw a lot of this during COVID-19. We attempted at BizNews we always attempt to put both sides of the story. And during COVID-19, the mere fact that we put both sides of the story got us struck out twice by YouTube, which is you got to get your distribution through YouTube. And it brought all kinds of attacks from other media players simply on the basis that we were giving people who had an alternative view that I did not necessarily agree with, but that's what media is supposed to be about, a platform to say what they were saying. And one of them that most obvious example is Tim Noakes, who is one of the great researchers around the world, acknowledged all over the world as being someone who knows what he's talking about and researches it and believes in science, that you should be always trying to check if you're wrong rather than trying to prove that you're right. And Tim was somebody who was absolutely vilified in, and still is, in certain corporate circles and in parts of the media. So I'd give a person like Tim and others who stood up during the difficult circumstances those badges of honor, those badges of courage. But let's move on to something that's maybe a little more, I suppose, in people's minds right now, and particularly those who do not like the capitalist activist Mr. Herzog's views, and that's what's happening with Dimension Data. Now, you came out very strongly last week about Dimension Data. I had a call from an old friend, Stephen Nathan, who worked for Deutsche Bank as one of the top analysts in the country, and at the time, he then went and started 10X, which he recently, a couple of years ago, sold out of. Now he's busy doing his own independent thing, but a really good man. He said, hey, it's not me. I'm not the Stephen Nathan who was playing both sides in this Data Campus story.
There are two Stephen Nathans.
There are. So it wasn't me. So anybody who thinks it's that Stephen Nathan, please just correct your view. But Rob, have you changed your view on what's happening, given that the Didata protagonists, as they're called, have now been very public in what they think is wrong, and that they've formulated their leave to appeal, or their document, which says we need to appeal this because another judge is going to kick Judge Denise Fisher's judgment out?
So I always preface everything I said, but if the judgment is correct, if the judge has done a good job, because I read one document, the judgment, and as I said, it read like a crime novel. And since then, a lot of people have also read it and go, that was really easy reading and fascinating and well-structured and a crime novel. But in the week since we spoke about it, you know, I've obviously taken a lot of phone calls of people who are supporting adding more grist to the mill, more fuel to the fire, but also people saying, you know, what the judgment missed, what I might have missed. You know, I did sort of maybe insinuate that Weber's was on the side of the protagonist. They're not. Weber Wenzel's very much handling the BEE structure, and they're very upset with the situation. So credit to Weber Wenzel for being on that side of the story and being up front. They're an excellent law firm. I use them, not WorkSoons. And, you know, what I've heard is given me some doubt about the judgment. I think attacking the judge is a bad thing to do and a wrong thing to do, and that's a mistake if the protagonists are using that as part of their armory. But, you know, having heard quite a bit from the other side, I think that their statement and their appeal should be heard. There are tons of affidavits that haven't come out yet, which I didn't realize. It's just quite an interesting case where there isn't a jury. I mean, the judge hears both sides, makes a judgment, and then they wait for the affidavits. So I think there's still quite a lot of evidence to come out to justify or vilify what's in the judgment. And I think it's two, three years we're going to have to wait before this thing comes to light. I mean, the only two things that I have in my mind just a query is, why did the protagonist suddenly say, okay, we're happy to walk away if you indemnify us? That's always an odd thing to hear. And if NTT and its lawyers had full access and transparency, if the protagonists had been fully transparent, why did NTT continue pursuing it? So I think there's stuff we don't know, but I think we've got to have an open mind. We can't prejudge the judgment. And as there's an appeal, and we're going to wait and see what happens. So, you know, within the protagonists, there's some very good, decent, honest people. I mean, I've had so many people call and say, so-and-so, there's no way they would be involved in something illegal. Maybe people were pulled along with something that they didn't understand that they were doing. I think lots still to come.
Exactly. And I think that's the whole point of keeping an open mind. And we've been publishing both sides of the story wherever we can. I do, like you, though, think that if you start playing the man, in this case the woman, rather than the ball, you already put yourself on the back foot. The one thing I would have liked to have seen is a timeline, because now we haven't got a definitive timeline. You know, Rob, for a very brief period, more than 20 years ago, I worked for a couple of years at ABSA and was looking after their group communications. And one of the things I did, because there were many complicated issues, the lifeboat, the fight with Julian Askin over Tollgate, there were many issues that were hard to understand, but I quickly managed to by putting a timeline on it. Well, this happened, and then that happened, and then the next thing happened, and then the next thing happened. And by following a timeline, you can see, looking backwards, what the motivations were of the actions that were taken. And if we could get a timeline on this, because the argument I've heard is the management team, or the protagonists, as they are called, had put together this deal on the campus because they were going to buy the company back from the Japanese. That was the assumption. Jeremy Ord had made a presentation in London in mid-January of the year, and then in February, and it appeared as though the Japanese were going to sell the business back to the protagonists, but then in February of the year, they changed their minds, or apparently changed their minds, or let's see the timeline. That's really the story for me. I would understand it so much better and do when you have these complicated issues. You know, it's funny, the pieces just fall into place when you look at it in the context.
You know, Alec, you said two things, if I can jump on. The one is, if I've been, or you've been, or someone has been accused of something, a one paragraph statement should be enough to solve the problem, not 75 pages of judgments and affidavits. I am innocent because blah, 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 blah. It should be in one paragraph. The protagonist should say, we are innocent because of the following. Back one paragraph. Why can't that be done? Or you're guilty because blah, 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 blah. The second point is you're talking about a timeline, which has made me think about Operation Warp Speed. Operation Warp Speed was introduced in America to accelerate the development and approval of drugs for COVID. Okay? And the development of the drugs was done in, I think, just like 7 days. The scientists said, okay, we're going to go get a drug to protect you against COVID. Bang. And then the approval was warp speeded to, I don't know, 6 months or something. Why shouldn't that Operation Warp Speed be applied to everything? So, you know, in developing Cape Winelands Airport, you know, you've got to do an environmental report, then it's got to be reviewed, and then it takes 6-8 months. Why can't that be done in a month? Well, the environmental people say, you've got 2 weeks to get the environmental report done, and you've got 2 weeks to respond, and the decision's made in 30 days. Why can't that happen? Why does everything have to take so long? You know, approval of drugs, legal issues, everything should be done. We've got AI, we've got, you know, digital magical powers in the world. Why can't more things be done at warp speed? Why does everything take so long?
Well, you're coming from the position of Rob Herzog's urgency. You're not coming from the position of a bureaucrat who likes to have meetings and to have, not to offend anybody in the meetings, and to have meetings about meetings, etc. And you come across it. In fact, I shouldn't just restrict this to bureaucrats. Many corporations work in a similar way as well. So it is a massive wastage in our world. I suppose as an investor, your point would be, let's try and find those companies that don't have this clogging up of their systems. And as a country, i.e. Argentina, Let's have a country that is streamlining all of this, getting out all of the cement that have been clogging up the drains and so on. And it gets back to what we were saying in the beginning. It looks like there is a trend towards this.
A quick story. when I was at Harvard Business School in my first year, we were given case studies. So Harvard Business School doesn't teach by a lecturer lecturing. They give you a case study the day before, marketing, finance, you know, agribusiness, whatever. And you read the case study. It's got a story. And it always starts with, Alex stood up and walked to the window of his office because he knew he had to make a decision urgently on the future of his company. And then they describe the story, okay, of whatever happened to that. And then what you did as a Harvard Business School student, you'd have to read the case study and be ready to prepare the next day. And this professor would stand up, there'd be 90 of you in each section, and he'd randomly pick one of you. You go, okay, Stafford, I think you're going to open this case. And if you hadn't prepared, you fail that course. Bang, outright, you fail it. So there's this paranoia of who the hell is he going to choose? It's the Hunger Games, okay? And then the presenter presents, the student presents, professor's writing things on the board, and then he goes, any comments? And then you put your hands up in the class, and only at the last 10 minutes of the class does the professor summarize the story. But they would give us case studies some nights that is 30, 40, 50 pages long, and then we'd have two others to read. And it wasn't possible to read the case study, then reread it, mark it up, do the numbers and things like that. And what they were forcing us to do was make decisions based on not having 100% knowledge. So you'd have enough information, enough knowledge, but then you had to make a decision. And that's what you learn. So you learn to just try and digest something into, you know, summarize it in your brain and then say, do I buy the company or not? Do I invest? Do I not? Do I get that piece of equipment or don't I? You never have perfect information. So warp speed is the manifestation of that, you know, I've got enough information, I have to make a decision. Or I've got enough information, you can build the building or you can't build the building. And we need to implement that. We need to create Operation Warp Speed into government, into business, into our lives. It'll save us a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of waste. Sorry,
and I went off. Kills analysis paralysis. Just this to bring in the OBAS of
like,
Omaha.
Like Cyril's view. 19 members of his advisory board. I mean, nothing's going to come out of that. Nothing.
Warren Buffett says that when it comes to higher education, and well, I guess he's talking primarily now about business, he says all you need to do is to have case studies. That teaches you more. You don't need to know. He's suspicious of anything with a Greek symbol in it, any business or investment philosophy with a Greek symbol, but he says case studies. So what you've just described now, Rob, and the more you do that, as you did at Harvard, the better you'd presumably get at solving the next case study and the next case study and so on.
But it's too many lawyers, too many bureaucrats, too many administrators, too many people with political science degrees. Get them out of the way. You know, ESCOM's been fixed by two engineers, Teta Nyati, Dan Marikani. Hugely impressive. You look at David Masondo, finance guy, hugely impressive. You want people from the STEM subjects in business making decisions. You really do, in government and across the board. I mean, I keep saying it. Do not hire people with political science degrees. Do not for anything.
Rob, there are a couple more points that I'd like to pick up as we come to the end of our discussion today. And the one is just to have a shout out to you for your generosity in agreeing to, well, actually coming up with the idea and saying that why don't we sponsor 20 young people under the age of 21. I suppose we might make it 25. That's probably fairer. To come along to the BizNews conference and give them the free access. Now, when we put our conferences together, I can tell you our margins are very tight. So we can't just allocate 20 extra tickets. But what you've said is you'll pick up 10% of the bill. It's been followed by Magnus Haystack. He's going to pick up 10% of the bill. I think Adrian Gardner and Mantis, his company, he's certainly looking at it. And then one of our community members, Roy Jeffery, came back and said he'll definitely sponsor a participant. So thank you. Thank you for that. And we've already had a few people, young people, come through. We're going to ask then, I think, bump it up to 25, and we'll probably get more than enough young people, because I know at that age in my life, wow, what an advantage it would have been to actually be in the room. It's not that you can't see what the various keynote speakers are saying, because that's all going to be on YouTube in due course, but it's rubbing shoulders with those who are at the event. So thanks for that, Rob.
I'll do another 10%, and I just ask tribesmen, you know, just tell Alec directly, you'll do R1,000 or R4,000, whatever. And let's get lots of young people there. So I'll do another 10.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you. Your generosity is it's an investment, isn't it? It's paying it forward. It's In fact, I had another, before I forget, there was another member of the tribe who said, hey, thanks for telling us about investing in Palantir and NVIDIA and so on. I've done really well. I'd like to pay it forward and also to sponsor someone. So that's a nice approach. The other point I wanted to pick up with you on is the absolutely fascinating interview I had yesterday with Iraj Abedian. Now, Iraj is one of those just brilliant go-to guys because he spent 20 years in academia. He was the professor of economics at UCT. He then went and worked in corporate. He worked for Standard Bank for 4 years. He was effectively their face by being the chief economist. The Standard Bank chief economist, certainly those days, was a very much a go-to guy and all over the media. And then the last 20 years, he's been running his own business in both private equity and in research. So he's had private sector, academia, and corporate. And he is also Iranian. So he grew up in Iran. In fact, he was there. He worked in the Iranian government at the time and just after the revolution in 1979. And his insights on Iran really shocked me. Things like the way that women are treated in Iran, constitutionally, in the law. The way Iraj explains it is that a small sect of Islam, very radical, hardcore, managed through the machinations of the great powers to take control and then told the great powers to up yours. And as a consequence of that, they've been able to implement things like women are, by law, half a man. So he says, for instance, if you have something where you need two men to sign a document, well, you'll need four women. And it's as radical as that. If women want to travel anywhere, they've got to find a man to accompany them and so on. Which is, it just blows my mind. Naledi Pandor, the South African Minister of International Relations, was cozying up to this regime in a huge way, given that she's a woman, just for starters. So I just want to understand a little more what might be behind this. Why is the ANC... Why is MTN, MTN are making money, so you can understand that. But why is the ANC so off-piste with its own background and its own history in this relationship?
Because they have no morals, no principles, and no values. And she is a manifestation of that. I used to think she was okay. She's an absolute twit. And I wanted to say something else. She's horrific. The ANC are prostitutes. They were bankrupt, and they basically said, we take money from anyone that'll give it to us. And Iran said, here's the money. Now you need to attack Israel. You need to wind up your nice, decent, hardworking, moderate Muslims in South Africa to be anti-Semitic. Imtiaz Suleiman is an example. And it's just gone haywire. And the ANC have been an absolute, you know, give us the money, we'll do whatever you tell us to do. Horrific. On the positive side, I want to just put a shout out to Ebrahim Rasool. I haven't met him yet. I want to meet him. He's the new South African ambassador to the US. And there was an article on him and an interview with him. And he basically said, we have to kill this kind of South Africa pro-Gaza, anti-Israel narrative and re-engage with America. You know, he'd been in America before, a prior role, and had built his kind of network of lefty ideologues, Marxists, you know, anti-Israel mob. But what he's saying is it's a new world now. We have to get South Africa back into the middle, realign or be not aligned, which I think is a smart thing to do. And he knows he needs to build deeper, broader, wider, better relationships in America with America and not bang on about this kind of Iranian narrative. Iran is on the back foot, and ANC is going to have to distance itself from Iran as quickly as possible and put Naledi Pandor out to pasture, and let's not hear from her again. She's a disaster.
Well, she's out to pasture, so she has retired, resigned, whatever. She's gone. As far as the public platform is concerned. But you still have a situation in the world where we have a non-aligned position, but we get aligned. And that's really strange. I think you're so spot on, Rob, when you say that what a good place to be neutral in this very, very complex world. And South Africa is trying to achieve that. But by doing these kind of things, it kind of shoots.
So Alec, what I love, you know, all the troubles in South Africa were stirred up by Iran paid proxies who flew down here and wound up our Muslim community against the Jewish community and created a lot of nastiness and anti-Semitism. What I'd like to do is re-engage, have the Judeo-Christian South Africans re-engage with the Muslim South Africans. Put aside what's going on internationally and focus on what's good for South Africa. Let's get back to working together, being cousins, you know, passing the goodness forward and focusing on what's good to South Africa. Put Iran and the international situation away and focus on the brotherhood and sisterhood that we had before. I really think it's time to do that now. Cut the links with Iran.
Second level thinking, and a good place to start is go and listen to or go and watch the Iraj Abedian interview on BizNews. His credentials are established very clearly in that discussion, and his insights are so valuable to those who've been grabbing headlines and allowing those to make opinions. And here, I would urge all of my Muslim friends, of which I have many, it's not, as Iraj says, the Iranian government is not a Muslim government. It's a Muslim country, and 90% of the people do not want that government. But it is part of a small sect that is, he says, has invaded and taken over.
Free Iran.
Rob, just to close off with, you're on your way to Tanzania next week, so we're not going to talk next week. We will, though, pick up in 2 weeks' time, just before you go to Antarctica. Why Antarctica? It's a bit cold there, and we're in summer now.
It's a bucket list. I really am so excited. When I saw that the gardeners, you know, Mansus Collection had been down there and were raving about it, I said, I've got to go. And I said to my wife, I know it's summer, and I know it's beautiful weather. If we can get to Antarctica, let's go and have a look. So we're going down with Jeannie D, Brandon Becker, Trevor McLean Anderson, couple of friends. It's an out and back. It's an out and back trip. But we'll send some fun pictures, okay?
What do you mean out and back? You're not going to stay there. You're not going to sleep over, are you?
No. We're flying down. It's a 6-hour flight. Land on the ice on the continent of Antarctica. We're spending 8-9 hours exploring ice wall and roaming around and then flying back. And a big Russian illusion, you know, those with the wings. And how exciting. I think Ripples, the nickname for my wife, or Crypto Queen, has got us. She's got us Emperor Penguin outfits to wear, all of us. Wait for the pics.
Rob Herzhoff in an Emperor Penguin outfit. That's going to be well worth watching. Well, Rob, thanks again for sharing your insights with us on the Thursday show. As mentioned, Rob will be taking a break next week. He's away in an area where connectivity is not that great. But we'll be back again with the Thursday show in 2 weeks' time before our official Christmas break. Until then, cheerio.